You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Well, hello, Tamara here. It's time for yet another interview. This one is super interesting. Why, you ask? Because it's a podcast about questions, not answers. In fact, it's about the power of what Warren Berger calls beautiful questions. These are not the questions you've been asking for the past years. It's not the same ones that have made you bang your head against the wall. No, no. These are questions that lead to new paths of thinking and hence new solutions. Here's the thing I'd like you to consider. Our expertise can be our own worst enemy. It's the curse of knowledge. But questions can pull you out of the weeds of what you think you know and ignite new possibilities, ones that aren't the way it's always been done. And I think you and I both know that the way it's always been done is not going to allow you to keep up in this marketplace today. So Warren Berger is the author of the book, Beautiful Questions. And on today's podcast, we question everything. And we talk about the question enemies that are keeping you in status quo. All right, let's go. Warren, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Tamara. It's great to be with you.
So since our first time meeting, what is your first memory of being innovative? And maybe in your case, it's being a questioner.
Well, you know, I was when I was a kid, I was very creative in terms of using my imagination to create my own games with my friends or even by myself. I remember when I was ill as a child, I actually created my own board game around baseball and using statistics and something. I can't even remember, but it was a very elaborate game that I made from scratch. So I was doing stuff like that, you know. I was pretty creative when I was a kid, and I was questioning a lot. And then I think early in my career, I was questioning whether I should stay on a traditional job path, and I just started to sort of create my own freelance way of working. You know, back before it was so common to do that. So I think, I've been doing that both in childhood and then into my career. I've been sort of questioning and creating new paths.
So I have to know, did you get anybody to play the game with you? Your statistics baseball game?
Just my brother.
I was wondering if it actually works.
I played a number of times, and he was an older brother, and he was quite taken with all the work that I'd put into it. It was a tremendous amount of labor that went into making this game.
Oh my gosh, that's great. So, you know, I was going to ask you how you became so obsessed with questioning, but maybe that's still the right question, but I wanted to ask you that a little bit differently, which is, when did you recognize the power of questions? Because it sounds like you've always done it, but when did you know that it was more than just, I asked some questions here and there?
Well, I think there's two parts to that answer. I first recognized a certain part of the power of questioning as soon as I became a journalist. Because as a journalist, you realize very quickly how important questions are and how, you know, if you ask the right question, you're going to get an answer that's going to lead you deeper into the story. And if you ask the wrong question, you know, the interview might sort of break down. So I really, very early on in my career, I started to focus on questioning from that standpoint. But that was a very limited appreciation of the power of questioning. I was really only thinking about it from the standpoint of a journalist and the way a journalist tries to use questioning to sort of...
It's more investigative.
Pull information out of people, right? So that was that. I understood that. But what I didn't understand until many years later was how powerful a tool it is for, let's say, innovators and entrepreneurs and people who are trying to create something new. I didn't realize the way that they're using questioning, which is less, it's less a kind of questioning where you ask somebody else something to try to pull information out of them. And it's more the kinds of questions you ask yourself. And you might ask those questions collaboratively with a group of other people, but you're sort of asking these big questions like, you know, why hasn't someone, you know, come up with a better way to do X? And if we were going to try to tackle this problem, you know, why would we do it? Why would we want to take this on? And what would be the first thing we might try? So, you know, I found that innovators were great at asking those kinds of questions. And that just opened up a whole new world for me, because now I started to realize, okay, questioning isn't just a communication tool. It's something else. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of living in the world. And once I started to think about it that way, that really opened up a whole new universe.
So you've said a couple of things in there that I want to explore a little bit further. And I'm, you know, I'm sitting here kind of my wheels turning a little bit thinking about, I think, you know, when you look back at origin stories of innovators, and whether that's inside a company or, you know, Mike Dubin from Dollar Shave Club, whatever it is, it right. really did start with a, why can't we do this better? What's the new path? Where's the missed opportunity? At a question that they, at least they have percolating in their mind, if not, right. you know, with a group of people around them. But you said something in the beginning of that about, you know, the wrong, and this was in regards to journalism, but I think it applies here. The wrong question, you know, takes you down one path, and the right one gets you kind of what you need or down the story, down the path. And I think in your book of Beautiful Questions, you talk about that. You know, it's the right questions, the beautiful questions. How do you know if you're asking the wrong questions versus that that other side of the coin, those beautiful questions?
Well, it's hard to know until you see the reaction to the question or you see what happens as you begin to work on that question or pursue that question. What I find is that a beautiful question has a powerful effect. It it tends to shift people's thinking. It tends to open up a conversation. It has all of these positive effects that become apparent pretty quickly. If you're asking the wrong question, that will become apparent too, because you'll sort of reach a dead end, or you will, you know, you'll find that people don't respond well to the question. You'll find that it's not really leading you anywhere. So I haven't really found a formula per se that allows you beforehand to say, this is a great question and this isn't. It's more like you have to try lots of questions, and you will see when you hit a good one, you'll be able to tell by the power that it has and the way it affects other people around you, the way it affects you yourself. That question will, you know, might open up your imagination. So so that's kind of one thing I say about it. Now, the only thing I will say about bad questions is, you know, you can, I think of, the only rule I would say about a bad question is, questions should be coming from a place of honesty and curiosity. You know, curiosity right. is really critical to good questions. And I find a lot of times we ask questions, but we're not really interested in the answer. We're sort of doing it kind of like a how are you question. You know, we're doing it out of habit, or we're doing it in this kind of automatic way. So one rule I would say to people about questioning, there aren't a lot of rules about it, but one rule I would say about questioning is, it's really powerful when your questions are grounded in curiosity. When you really care about the question, that will show, and that will other people will see that, and they will respond better to the question.
Is that a matter of, you know, you kind of hear about active listening or whatever you want to call it? You know, sometimes I feel like my dad does this to me. I adore him. But, you know, he asks me a question, but then he doesn't actually, he's not listening to the answer. So, right. you know, it, that's one thing. But is kind of that what you're saying? I totally threw my dad under the bus. Poor guy. He's amazing. I feel bad now. Yeah, he totally does that to me. But
well, I think lots of dads. that's part of it. Yeah. Like, I think active listening is a big part of questioning, because one of the things that's really important with questioning is to follow up on what you're learning and what you're hearing. And I always say about questioning, you know, your questions should always be evolving and changing and adapting. So for instance, if you're in a conversation with someone, you might start out with one question you ask them, but based on how they respond, you'll come back with a different version or a different question that tries to go deeper on what they just said. Sometimes this is referred to as a follow-up question, right? So you can only do that if you're listening. You know, you can't really ask follow-up questions and you can't improve your question to another person and go deeper unless you're listening to what they're saying in response to your first question. So that's why listening is so big, and it's something people really miss. I find people when they're doing, let's say they're doing an interview, a job interview, they're interviewing someone that they want to hire, or they're interviewing someone that is a potential partner to them. One of the things they'll do is they'll have a list of questions, right? And they'll be so anxious to just go down that list of questions that they really don't listen to the answers because they're already starting to move on to the next question. And that's a big mistake. You should always be focused on what the person is saying in response to your question and figuring out, is there another question I can use now to dig deeper on what they're saying or to maybe shift it in a different direction? That's really the art of questioning. When you can do that well, that's when you're a good interviewer, as well as a good conversationalist, not just interviews, but just conversations. You want to be able to do that. That's a really important skill.
You know, what I really appreciate about what you're saying, Warren, is that it sounds to me like it's almost one big experiment, but the focus is on the questions, not necessarily the answers. Meaning, you know, you ask that first question, you see, did it open people up? Did it make them think differently? Oh, wait, where do I dig given what they said? Okay, it didn't open them up. Let me try this a different way. Let me ask this question instead. I think we spend so much time thinking of worrying about the responses that we're not actually thinking about the questions that we're asking. And I really, if I hear you right, that's part of this that I really appreciate about what you're saying.
Yeah, I think so. Well, you know, this is part of, I guess, my overall philosophy is that we always spend too much time on the answers. You know, it has to do with our culture and our society. And I understand that. I mean, you know, it's answers are great. You know, answers, we feel like answers are what solve the problems for us and lead us in new directions. And to some extent, that's absolutely true. But what we miss in putting all the value on answers and very little value on questions, the thing we're missing out is that the questions are often critical to get us to the answers. They're like the first step on the journey. And so if you don't take that first step, or if you don't do the first step right, if you step in the wrong direction, you're not going to get to your destination, right? So that's what we're missing in the value equation that we've created that says answers are everything and questions are, yeah, they don't matter so much.
Well, and I think that when we start with one question and then just go down that path, we miss all these other paths that could be worth exploring, or nuggets of those paths could be worth exploring. But, you know, kind of to your point, we ask one question, we check it off, and then we move on and we get the answer. And then we go to the next one and we check it off. And, you know, very quickly, I'll tell you, I have a friend who was asked to be an Imagineer for Disney, which is, by the way, my total dream job, Disney, if you're out there. I mean, wouldn't that be amazing? But the goal of his group was to build a better parade, which is a pretty big goal. Mm. I mean, their parades are pretty awesome to begin with. And they just, you know, 3 days in their creative room with all the whiteboards, they were struggling. They had nothing but, you know, pizza boxes and empty coffee pots to show for it. So they brought in a little girl, and she really wasn't very interested in their conversation and kind of tuned out. But at some point she looked at all these Imagineers and said, well, why do parades have to be on the ground? And right. That's when these guys came up with this parade in the sky. But it was kind of that one beautiful question. Absolutely. That nobody had thought to ask and I'd love to hear your perspective on this. It seems like we put so many layers of rules and assumptions on even our questions, forget the answers for a second, that we don't even get to those thought-provoking questions.
Yeah, you see, that example you just cited is a textbook case I would say, for what I mean by a beautiful question. Okay. Because people are always asking me that, you know, because I made it the title of the book, and they said, well, what do you mean by a beautiful question? You know, does it have to be worded in elegant language or whatever? And so what I try to say to people is, it's all about the effect that the question has on other people. Now, that example you just cited, you know, as soon as that girl articulated that question, everyone said, wow, I never thought of it that way before. And it suddenly changed their thinking. And there are so many stories in my book that are exactly like that, right? Someone, and in fact, there is a story about a little girl asking a question that led to the Polaroid instant camera. And so there are so many questions that they come out of left field. They may not seem like they're the most sophisticated question or the most elegantly worded question, but what they seem to be doing is turning our assumptions upside down. And when a question can do that, when it can challenge our pre-existing notions, that's when it's really powerful, because that's when we step back and say, wait a minute, why haven't I been thinking this way before? And when that happens, you know you've got a beautiful question on your hands.
I love those questions because I find that people on the other side of the table, it makes them go, oh, like, how dare, it's almost a how dare you ask that, because it's so thought provoking.
People get scared by those kinds of questions too. They get both excited by them, and sometimes they get angry at them. But it evokes an emotional response.
Which is, I think, how you know you've got it right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So will you share a business story of whether that's an organization or a team that kind of that questioning led to a breakthrough in some way?
Oh, sure. Well, I think there's so many of the tech companies, you know, if you look at Netflix, for example, you know, Netflix going all the way back to its origin started with a question. And it was the founder, Reed Hastings, just at the time, you know, Blockbuster was the dominant force in the video field, and he was renting videos from Blockbuster. He had that classic problem that people used to have with Blockbuster video stores back then, which is right. He held onto the movie way too long. He all of a sudden he returned it. He got this ridiculous late fee that was like more than the movie cost itself, you know. And he just started to question, why do I have to go through this, and why is there is this the only way to rent movies or watch movies, that you have to go through this weird system? And then he started to question. There's a kind of questioning you can do that I call connective inquiry, where you connect ideas from different areas and you say, what if I connected this with that? And he asked, you know, what if you had a health club, a video rental system that was more like a health club, you know, where you were a member. And you, as part of your membership, you didn't have to worry about how long you had the movie and all of that sort of thing. So that became the model for Netflix. And then I think even as Netflix became a company, a successful company, and grew, you can see the questioning that was always going on within Netflix. Like, you know, okay, we've conquered this idea of the video rental. But what about the content? What about the movies themselves? You know, how can we get into that area? And how would we take what we have in our existing business and then expand into this whole other area, which they were able to do? So I think they also, by the way, you know, Netflix has been rethinking and reinventing everything to do with human resources and the way you do vacation policy in your company. And they've basically questioned almost everything that every business practice you can think of, sometimes with good results, sometimes not, usually with good results. So I hold them up as an example of not only the entrepreneurial company that starts with a question, but then the company that, as it becomes established and grows, continues to question. And that's really important, because what I see a lot is, yeah, businesses will be questioning and curious and innovative when they're young and starting up.
Well, it's easy then.
It's easy then. Yeah. Once they become established and they start to get some rules in place, then all the questions stop. You know, then it's like, okay, we've got a bunch of rules now, And that's what we're going to follow. We're going to follow the company rule book and no more questions, you know. So that's when I think they get into trouble. So the real secret is not only to be questioning as an entrepreneurial startup, but how do you keep on questioning as you become established?
And, you know, the other thing that you said in there that I want us launch readers to pay attention to is it doesn't have to be kind of a sexy technology. You know, you talked about kind of internal human resources. I have a fantastic client over at Arrow Electronics, which is, you know, billion-dollar global electronic parts, basically. I mean, this is not a sexy business. More importantly, the team that I worked with was an internal audit team, meaning process improvement. And one of the biggest challenges they have is collecting the documents they need to do their jobs. As you can imagine, very hard to get that. Multiple people, multiple things. And one of them during our session together just piped up and said, well, what if we flipped it? What if we're not asking the question, how do we make getting the documents, you know, faster, smoother? What if we ask the question, how do we already have the documents before we get started? And I'd love to follow up with them and find out where that question led them. But to your point, you know, that question is going to take them down a whole new path of solutions that will help them, because that other question, they've been asking that same question for 10 years and banging their heads against a wall because it's not getting them anywhere.
Yeah, it's a classic situation. You see it so often in business where the business becomes obsessed with, for example, how do we take this 5-step process we're doing and squeeze it down to 3 steps? And so the company will be going, you know, on and on about how do we take the 5-step process and make it 3 steps. And all of a sudden, someone will come along and say, wait a minute, why are we doing this process in the first place? You know, this sales approval process, let's say, why do we have this multi-step process in the first place? Does it still make sense? And then you find out, gee, it made sense 5 years ago when we didn't have the technology we have now. But it really doesn't make sense now to have all these steps and layers. So this is what companies need to do all the time. They need to constantly be asking, you know, why are we doing this? Why are we following this process we're following? What's the rationale behind it? What are the possible alternatives? What if we turned the whole system upside down and did it completely differently? What would that look like? Companies need to be asking those questions all the time, and they usually don't, because they don't make time for that. They're afraid to do it. They're afraid of, oh, gee, if I question the existing process, I might not have an answer of what to do instead. And they're afraid of that. They're afraid of that uncertainty. And, you know, I what I say to that is, you know, don't be afraid of the uncertainty, because you have to get to new answers. They're not necessarily going to fly into your head out of the sky. You may have to work toward them. But if you're not willing to even ask the questions in the first place, then you've got no chance.
So let's talk a little bit about the don't side of it, why we don't do it and kind of stick to status quo or not questioning. And I know I think it's in your book, and I know I read an article about the 5 enemies of questioning. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, I think that, you know, this gets absorbed by us when we're very young and we're kids, because we start out as questioners, right? Anybody who's seen a young child, really young child, like 4 or 5 years old, knows that they're asking lots and lots of questions. So it's kind of a natural behavior that surfaces in us at a very early age. And then what happens is we question less and less as we grow older. And I think it's because of, you know, there's different theories on why that's happening and different factors. But I believe there's a handful of factors that really are important. And one is fear. You know, we start to develop as we grow older, self-consciousness and a fear about what other people are going to think of us. If we ask a question, maybe it will make us look stupid. So the fear is a big factor. Knowledge actually can be an enemy of questioning, because as you start to feel like you know more about something, you question less. You fall into that sort of trap of expertise where, oh, I've figured this out already. I don't need to question it anymore. And this gets back to people doing routines at work, right? Doing the same thing over and over. They think they've figured it out already, so why question it? big mistake, especially when times are changing and the world is changing. You have to, even if you think you know something, even if you think you've figured something out, you at least occasionally have to step back and question it a little bit.
You know, as I'm just going to interrupt you really quickly and tell you that one of the things I started doing on that, because I think we all suffer from the curse of knowledge in a lot of ways, is every time when I'm talking to my team in particular, every time I think I know kind of what they're saying, like, okay, yeah, got it. You know, that moment where you just kind of nod your head. I actually have been forcing myself to stop and ask another question before we move on. And it's fascinating to me how wrong I've been getting it. You know, like, not wrong, yeah, it's not, I wasn't on the mark. I thought I wasn't right.
Yeah, that is everyone is prone to that. And it's, you know, we overestimate our own knowledge about things and our own expertise. And we're always seeing things from our own limited view. You know, that's just human nature. So you have to force yourself to overcome those problems. And one of the ways you do it is through questioning. I've found it's a great tool for getting yourself to challenge yourself and to get yourself out of bad habits. You know, you can just say, okay, whenever I'm doing this kind of behavior, I'm going to stop and ask myself this question. And a lot of times that question can just be the little thing that jogs you. It makes you realize, oh, you know, I got to be careful about making assumptions here, or I've got to be careful about my own biases. It can really help to check certain behaviors that are built into us. So, biases, and that's, by the way, biases, that's another enemy of questioning. You know, our own built-in biases will cause us to not question things that we should question. So we just assume, oh, that's the way it should be, because we have a certain bias. And so we have to question our biases as well. And then, of course, the biggest enemy of questioning, I think, is time. I think it takes time. You know, it takes time to step back. I always think of questioning, for some reason, I always think of the metaphor of stepping back. I don't know why, but I always think of when you're asking questions, you're stepping back, right? I guess you're trying to, in my mind, you're usually trying to step back from the rush to just keep doing things, or you're stepping back from your own kind of biases. And you're trying to see things with a fresh perspective and ask questions. So I think it takes time to do that. It takes time to step back. It takes time to ask questions and consider them. And, you know, from the time we're in school till the time we're in business, we are always taught, you know, just get it done, get it done, get it done. And a lot of times it might seem like questioning runs counter to that. It's more about thinking and wondering and inquiring, and it's not so much about getting stuff done. And because of that, people have a kind of a negative reaction to it sometimes, and feel like, hey, we don't have time for that. We don't, you know, that's a luxury we just don't have time for.
Do you think our you know, I feels, I'm not even trying to ask a question, but it feels like we put this badge value on being busy, right? Oh my God, I've got 100 meetings, 100 emails to answer, so many calls to make, busy, busy, busy. But how does that impact our ability to just, to your, kind of your point, take a step back and percolate and ask questions and actually think things through?
I think it's a big problem. And, you know, it's tied in with that time issue, because once we've gotten into the cult of being busy, you know, we will find ways to fill every possible moment of our day with a task, right? And there's a great analogy that someone in Silicon Valley, Paul Graham, used, which is about the maker's schedule versus the manager's schedule. And he talked about how when you think like a manager, you fill every moment of your day with some type of a little task that has to get done. When you think like a maker, you will set aside blocks of time simply to create. And you won't fill your entire schedule with just little tasks. You'll leave open space for creativity. And I think questioning ties in with that. I think we need to leave a little open space in our schedule for thinking, for questioning, for wondering, and for creating. Because those things work a little differently than the managerial behavior. You know, the managerial behavior is all about responding. It's all about putting out fires. You know, it's all about having meetings. But the other kind of thinking is about slowing down. It may be about cutting yourself off from distraction. It's a whole different mode that you have to go into. But it's really critical, because if you want to be a creative thinker, you want to solve problems, you want to come up with new ideas, you need to have some of that time blocked off for questioning, wondering, creating, connecting ideas, that sort of thing.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but that ability or need to question, to get to those more innovative solutions and ideas, just down new paths, that you don't need to be a leader to do that.
No, I don't think so. Not at all. I mean, I think, well, one of the things I talk about in the book of Beautiful Questions is, first of all, I think we're all leaders, right? I mean, we are. A leader is a state of mind, you know. It's not so much about your rank within an organization. And that's why we're seeing, I don't know if you've been noticing, but there's a tremendous boom in the popularity of leadership podcasts, leadership books, leadership publications. Now, those are not all being read by CEOs. You know, what that means is that everybody now is interested in leadership. And I think that's a wonderful thing. That's great, because it means people are recognizing that you can be a leader within your own sphere, whatever that may be. It may be your family, it may be your community, it may be the team that you're part of within a larger company. But there's room for you to be a leader in lots of little places. So I don't think, first of all, I think, you know, to be a leader, you have to ask questions, you have to be curious. But I also think that it's important to absorb this idea that leadership is not just for the top people running an organization.
Yeah, it's, you know, kind of in parallel to that is I believe very strongly that anyone can be an innovator too. So we can all apply innovative thinking to our jobs, regardless of if you, you know, work the kiosk part-time in a mall or you're the CEO of a company or anywhere in between. And if we look at the great innovations out there, and I'm not just talking about the Ubers and whatever, but things that have, you know, transformed a company, impacted the bottom line, made things better, they come from all over the organizational ladder if people are paying attention.
They totally do. And that's one of the reasons I sometimes have an issue when companies create these divisions within the company that they say, this is our innovation division, you know, or our creative department, you know, and because think about the message that's sending to everybody else at the company. Okay, you're not innovative, you're not creative, only the people in this group are. But also it's just missing the fact that creativity and innovation comes from all over. It can come from any part of the organization, and you want it to come from all over. I mean, you want that person who's on the front lines dealing with a customer in customer service, you want them to be innovative, because they're going to see something, right? They're going to see a problem, you know, that oh, there's something we're doing wrong in our customer service. There's a way we're responding to customers that's not working. And what if we tried changing it by doing X or Y? You want people thinking like that at every level, every position within an organization.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have time for me to go on my soapbox about why it's such a bad idea to silo innovation. But I think one of the key points you pointed out there is, you know, the message it actually sends to everybody else is actually hindering your company more than having those 10 people with the cool t-shirts in the cool building. And, you know, I'll never forget, I was doing this keynote and this woman came up to me after from a massive law firm that's based here in Colorado, but, you know, huge firm. And she said, we didn't talk about the siloing of innovation. It wasn't part of this session, but she said, so I have to ask you, so my company created this, they just hired a chief innovation officer, and then they assigned, you know, 5 people to the innovation team. And, you know, they kind of get to do, like, they're the ones responsible for all the innovation of the company. What do you think about that? And before I responded, I just said, well, how does that make you feel? And yeah. She stopped and she goes, you know, it kind of makes me feel like SHIT.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Basically it's like telling me that I'm not good enough to come up with new ideas. I was like, well,
yeah.
Right.
And you know, this is such a big issue for companies today. And a lot of them don't appreciate how big an issue it is.
Yeah.
It affects the company in so many ways. not just innovation, not just that you're cutting off the source of ideas and possible innovation from 90% of your company. That's bad enough. But what it's also doing is it's demotivating people.
Right.
It's telling them that they should leave their creativity at home.
You know,
that
right.
They should,
but
that
not here. Not don't do it here.
Yeah, it's not
well,
needed.
We're paying you.
Once you do that to people, you know, it's only a matter of time before they move on and they go elsewhere. You know, it's going to happen. So I think, you know, I think this is so critical in terms of issues like employee turnover, employee morale. You know, you want people to be using their curiosity, asking questions, trying to solve interesting problems. You want them doing that because it's going to ultimately make them more engaged. You're going to have a more engaged person working for your company. They're going to be more productive and they're going to stay there longer.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, I think the detriment is really bad. And kind of to your point about engagement, I mean, ultimately what we want is to feel like we're contributing to our work. So to tell people, well, you don't get to contribute. These other people do. And I do believe that, you know, you need to have people accountable for innovation. So you can have a chief innovation officer, you can even have a chief innovation team. But in my opinion, their job, if you're going to have some people accountable, their job is to enable everybody else to be responsible for innovation and to help them, not to silo it across the organization. I could go on about this topic in particular, obviously, but I want to kind of bring it back to you for a second and kind of questioning and innovating. How do you innovate? Is it in the questioning? Is that your kind of your way of innovating?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the way I innovate is I look at, you know, whatever subject I'm thinking about at the time, usually it has something to do with questioning. And I ask, you know, what's a fresh way of looking at this, or what's a new angle I can come at this from? Because I need to continually, let's say in my world, I need to continually put ideas out there so that a publication, for instance, will say, oh, that's a good idea. Let's write about that. And so in order to do that, I need to constantly be looking at my familiar subject material that I'm working with and say, what's a new way to present this? What's a new way to package this? What's a new way to come at this subject that I haven't come at it before? And so that's the way, the primary way I'm doing innovation and creativity. And it always involves questioning. It always involves, you know, me looking at some basic premise that I'm working on and then questioning, okay, what have I not considered about this? What am I missing here? What's another aspect of this story that I haven't talked about? And how do I find that? And how do I then pursue that and flesh it out? So that's the way I'm using it.
You know, we talked a little bit about what stops people from innovating, kind of the knowledge, the fear. Is there anything else that we didn't cover in that that you think we should be mindful of in kind of just how we act and behave?
Well, I think that, you know, just don't be afraid of not having answers to your questions. That's one of the big issues for people is they feel like if they question something, and it could be the way they do their job at work, or it could be something about their career path, basically anything. If they feel like if they question it, it's going to make everything fall apart, you know, because all of a sudden, if they start to question something that they're assuming and they don't have another answer to take its place, then they're going to be in this state of chaos and panic. So what I would say to people about that is don't be afraid of that, because that period of uncertainty is actually a great place to be sometimes. That's when you're going to be exploring. You're going to be trying to pursue new ideas. Your mind is going to open up. There's a great analogy that the designer Bruce Mao, who I used to work with years ago, said. He used to use an analogy about being lost in the woods. And he said, when you're lost in the woods, all your senses come alive and you begin to become very, very creative at trying to figure out what to do and where to go and how to find your path. So don't be afraid of being occasionally lost in the woods. because it will activate your senses and it will make you more creative than you ordinarily are. That's the biggest thing for me, is that the fear of uncertainty keeps us from questioning, keeps us from exploring, and that also keeps us from innovating.
I think that was me on the highway the other day, trying to figure out where I was going. Right. All my senses heightened. We interviewed a while back someone near Yale. He wrote a book called Hooked, and it's all about how to make addictive products. But what relates to this that I found fascinating was he was talking about how the brain research has shown that our brain doesn't like open loops. So we don't like unanswered things. We try to put, a pretty bow on everything because our brain wants to move on. But what's cool about that, I think, connects to what you're saying about questions, is if we're willing to be uncomfortable and stay in that state of unknown, all of our senses will be heightened. We just have to be willing to sit in it a little bit longer to kind of keep everything firing and moving versus trying to put it in a pretty bow too soon.
Yeah, it's a little uncomfortable. I mean, it's like someone that wrote about it and described it as butterflies in the stomach, when you're dealing with uncertainty. And I guess the secret is to learn to enjoy that and that feeling, and learn to enjoy those butterflies, because when that's happening, you're a little more alive and you're a little more creative. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, I happen to really like that uncomfortable place.
Right.
In fact, I would I'm more comfortable being, with the butterflies in the stomach than I am when things are humdrum. But, but you have to get used to it. That was actually a skill I learned over time. I don't think it was something necessarily that was maybe a little bit ingrained in me, but it took skill. I ask you the last question, where can people go to get your book, learn more, connect with you? And we'll put all these links in the show notes.
Yeah. The best place is my main site is amorebeautifulquestion.com. Named after the title of my previous book, A More Beautiful Question. The current book is The Book of Beautiful Questions. But amorebeautifulquestion.com is where you'll find basically all the resources I've put together on questioning. So if you're interested in this subject, there's articles, there's quizzes you can take. There's a song list of songs that have questions for a title. I think I'm up to like 70 or 80 now.
Cool.
Yeah, if you know a song that has a question for the title and it's not on that list, let me know. Just anything question related that you can think of, it's questioning and school and your kids and questioning and all of that, it's all there on that site.
And kind of last question for you is, the question is, what's the first question we launch readers should be asking ourselves?
Oh, the first question is probably, am I making time for questioning? Okay, just ask yourself if you're doing it, if you're taking time to step back and question, because if you're not, try to figure out a way to make that part of your life and your schedule and your way of doing things. Try to make it a habit. Questioning is very much a habit. Once you get used to doing it, you'll do it naturally. Once you get used to questioning what people say to you or your own routines at work, you'll then do it instinctively.
This is a little bit of a tangent, maybe more of a global comment about the power of questions, but I think it's even more powerful and important now than ever before, because, when you watch the news in the morning or any media station, you really need to train yourself to question even what they're saying. And I just with the bots on Facebook, I just think that the need to question is even more important now than ever before.
It's huge. This whole idea of the information coming at us.
Yeah.
And by the way, this situation is not going to get better. It's going to get worse.
Yeah.
So the idea that we're going to be swamped with information that is unreliable, that's not going to go away. So it becomes more important than ever to have what has been referred to as a built-in BS detector.
Exactly.
And that BS detector runs on questions. That's the fuel it runs on.
Yeah. And thank you for putting up with my little side note there. But I just, I was just talking to my kids this morning as we were watching the news, and one of them said, I can't believe that. And my response was, well, why do you think that happened? Let's figure out what we're actually hearing. And I think in business, to kind of loop it back to that, yesterday's solutions don't solve today's challenges and tomorrow. So we have to keep questioning to figure out kind of what's even right in front of us now, because for most of us, those challenges that we're facing are new to the world. We haven't even seen them before. We don't even know what we're dealing with. So how else are we supposed to figure those out if we're not asking questions?
We can't, and we should embrace that. I mean, that's a wonderful thing. That's a great period to be living in when questioning is so valuable. Think about it. If we were living in a time when no one was expected or wanted to question, that would be a really bad thing. So just embrace the opportunity to be a questioner and be thankful for the fact that we're in a world right now where questioners thrive.
Well, this has been fantastic, Warren. Thank you so much for coming by Inside Launch Street.
Thank you. It was really great talking to you.
Got some questions to ask? My challenge to all of us is to pick one beautiful question and ask it today. See what happens. Then do me a solid. If you're new to this podcast and getting tons of value, go to iTunes and leave a review. More reviews equal more listeners, and more listeners equals continue to get high quality guests, and high quality guests equals more value for you. So actually, at the end of the day, it's kind of selfish in a good way. So go leave us a review. Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.